House of God. The poet did not think to specify, nor did any of his contemporaries. Perhaps, however, this was only to be expected. Literate people, after all, did not tend to live in the desert, or visit it either. Even if the habit of going on pilgrimage to Arabia had become well established before the time of Abd al-Malik, and there is no evidence that it had, then the mounting anarchy of the times would surely have halted the practice. As a result, among those believers sufficiently educated to put pen to parchment, the precise details of the distant desert sanctuary, even down to its very name, appear to have been a blur. The surest pointers to its location were to be found not in poetry, or in chronicles, or in gazetteers, but in stone. The years that followed Abd al-Malik's pilgrimage to Arabia saw workmen tinkering with the layout of numerous mosques. From the busiest stretch of the Nile to the loneliest corner of the Negev, Qiblas that had previously pointed east were painstakingly reoriented to the south. Meanwhile, in Kufa, the west-facing Qibla was carefully angled in an identical direction. The House of God no longer seemed to stand where it had previously, between Medina and Palestine. Rather, if the calculations of the mosque renovators were to be trusted, it lay much further to the south, at a site in the depths of the Hijaz, a site that can only have been the one place, Mecca. Naturally, such a change did not go unnoted. There were opponents of Abd al-Malik, a full 60 years on, who still damned him as the man who had destroyed the sacred house of God. Already, however, even in the immediate aftermath of his conquest of Arabia, confusion as to what might actually have happened and what constituted the sacred house of God was rife and escalating. Umayyad propagandists, while not denying the destruction wrought by al-Hajjaj, insisted that the true vandal had been Ibn al-Zubayr, and that Abd al-Malik had merely restored the Kaaba to its original pristine condition. Few Arabs thought to dispute this claim. The conviction that a sanctuary might be demolished and reconstructed, not once but several times, and still somehow remain numinously the same, was widely held. In due course, Abd al-Malik and Ibn al-Zubayr would take their places in a long list of people who had supposedly either repaired the House of God or rebuilt it from scratch, luminaries as heavyweight as Muhammad, Abraham, and Adam. The future of the Kaaba was one that would see it enshrined as both a marker of Adam's tomb and the pivot of the cosmos itself. If there was an echo in this sensational array of attributes of the traditions that Christians, in the wake of Helena's discovery of the true cross, had attributed to the rock of Golgotha, then that was surely no coincidence. Just as it had taken Constantine to establish once and for all the site of Jesus's crucifixion, so likewise, perhaps, had it needed a ruler such as Abd al-Malik, an autocrat no less visionary, self-confident, or domineering, to define for his own religion the eternal heartbeat of the world. None of which, of course, solves the mystery of why an obscure and barren spot 1,000 miles from the centre of Umayyad power should have been chosen for such an honour. Clearly, though, Abd al-Malik must have had reasons that far transcended the merely opportunistic. Just as he would never have promoted Muhammad as the founder of his religion without truly believing that the Prophet had been an authentic medium for the words of God, so would he never have gone on pilgrimage to a site that lacked any aura of the sacred. Long before his arrival there, a Kaaba must surely have stood on the spot. Perhaps, like the one at Baqa, it also had some association with Muhammad. If not, then the Umayyads would certainly have had both motive and opportunity for promoting it as the shrine named in the Prophet's revelations as Mecca. Muawiyah, based as he had been throughout his reign in Syria, had made a conscious effort to tighten his grip on Arabia. Any plot of land capable of supporting crops had been ruthlessly appropriated, its water supplies diverted, its settlements commandeered. In Medina, The intrusion of Umayyad henchmen into the oasis had only compounded the family's unpopularity and precipitated Ibn al-Zubayr's coup. But further south, in the Hejaz, the policy had reaped notably greater success. Indeed, Muawiyah's investment in the region had been so substantial that its summer capital, a flourishing oasis named Taif, was said to have migrated there from Palestine. Abd al-Malik's links to the town were probably even closer. Not only had his father, Marwan, served as its governor, but his most trusted lieutenant, al-Hajjaj, had grown up in the oasis. Both then would surely have been intimately familiar with the shrine that stood a mere 60 miles to the northwest, behind a wall of wind-scoured black-baked mountain, and which Abd al-Malik himself, in 694, made a point of honouring as the House of God, the shrine that posterity would commemorate as the Kaaba of Mecca. So it was that a second sanctuary, paired with the Dome of the Rock, came to be enshrined once and for all as a fit object of pilgrimage for the faithful. This much seems clear enough. Beyond that, however, everything is obscurity and murk. Was Abd al-Malik the first Amir to renovate the site, or did he follow in the footsteps of Ibn al-Zubayr? Where had the sanctuary demolished by al-Hajjaj stood? At Baqa or at Mecca? What had it been more important for the victor to establish? Continuity with the past or a clean break? Certainly, more than a century after the time of Abd al-Malik, a vague sense still lingered that the House of God might not always have stood rooted to the spot in Mecca. At the time of the Prophet, may God save him and give him peace, our faces were all turned in one direction. But after the death of the Prophet, we turned ourselves hither and thither. So one Muslim scholar would recall. Others, in the reports given of Mecca itself, might betray similar anxieties. It was not only the Kaaba in these stories that was forever being demolished and rebuilt. So, too, was the mosque that enclosed it. A sacred well was lost and then miraculously rediscovered on no less than 2 separate occasions. Most bewildering of all, perhaps, was the sheer range of sacred stones associated with the holy site, and which were forever being shifted or discovered. There was the Maqam Ibrahim, for instance, which had been carried along by a flood. Then there was the rock uncovered by Ibn al-Zubayr, and which had been stamped with the name of God. Finally, and perhaps most enigmatically of all, there was the much-venerated Black Stone, which enjoyed a prominent position in the wall of the Kaaba. Some claimed that Adam had found it, whereupon it had gobbled up the parchment on which was written his contract with God. Others insisted that it was Abraham who had excavated it, and that he and Ishmael had then lugged it all the way to Mecca. Still others claimed that Ibn al-Zubayr had placed it in an ark, of the kind used by Moses to transport the Torah around the desert. The Black Stone, it seemed, was not only fabulously ancient, it was surprisingly mobile as well. And as such, hardly unique. For any ruler who wished to veil the parvenu status of a recent foundation behind a sheen of class, a talisman like the Black Stone had long been an essential prerequisite. Antiquity, after all, spelled class. This was why Constantine, if the story that had him pilfering the Palladium from Rome were to be trusted, had brought to his upstart capital a touch of antique Troy. It was also why the Maubeds, back in the reign of Peroz, had no sooner lit the fire of the stallion amid the desolate peaks of Media than they were insisting that its flames were, in fact, eternal and had originally roamed the world. The claim, within a mere couple of generations, had worked a spectacular magic. Zoroastrians, appalled by Heraclius's destruction of the temple, had certainly had no idea that it might have been in existence for a mere century and a half. The past attributed to a sanctuary, especially of a lonely one, might bear witness not to the preservation of authentic customs, of authentic traditions, of authentic memories, but to the polar opposite, bold innovation. And certainly, in his determination to shape the world as he saw fit, Abd al-Malik was nothing if not a revolutionary. Even before his final victory over Ibn al-Zubayr, he had been plotting how to stamp his vast empire as he had already stamped Jerusalem, as hallowed by the authentic religion of God. In 691, the coins that had given Arkulf the reassuring delusion that Palestine still belonged to a Christian order had been reminted with images that owed nothing to Constantinople, a spear in a prayer niche, Abd al-Malik himself girt with a whip. Meanwhile, in Iraq, a matching program of reform saw the erasure from the coinage of every last trace of the House of Sasan. Nothing or no one was permitted to obstruct this policy. All the coins were to be standardized, and all were to promote the authority of Abd al-Malik's new religion. Long have you pursued a course of faction and followed the path of waywardness, but now, by God, I will beat you as one does a camel not of the herd at the watering hole. So thundered al-Hajjaj, following his appointment to the governorship of Iraq in 694. The warning was issued to a crowd of rebellious Basrans, but it might as well have been delivered to the Greek and Persian-speaking elites. Unsettling though they had found Abd al-Malik's initial reforms, far worse was brewing. An even more outright declaration of war against the past was about to be delivered. In 696, a radically new style of coin began to be minted, one that featured no images at all, but only writing, and Arabic writing at that. Nothing, to bureaucrats long accustomed to regard the language as a marker of barbarism, could possibly have been more shocking. The world, however, as Abd al-Malik did not stint in emphasizing, had been turned upside down. Coins were not the only expression of the new linguistic dispensation. So too were passports, and tax returns, and contracts, and laws, and receipts. Everything, in short, that made for the running of a global empire. To functionaries who suddenly found themselves with no prospect of employment unless they spoke or wrote in their master's language, this was an upheaval that shook the foundations of their entire world. To Abd al-Malik himself, of course, it was something much more. Arabic, in his devout opinion, was the proper language of empire, because it was also the language of God. Adorning the walls of the Dome of the Rock, fashioned out of cubes of brilliant gold, inscriptions proclaimed the core tenets of the Amir's faith, the prophethood of Muhammad, and the sheer folly of believing, as did the Christians in their blindness, that God might conceivably be three. Much of what was written consisted of excerpts patched together from the prophet's own revelations, the earliest surviving examples of phrases from the Quran. Posterity would claim that it was Uthman, decades previously, who had first collected and pieced these together, to compile what was, from that moment on, a fully formed scripture. But the snatches of verse patched together by Abd al-Malik on the Dome of the Rock suggest something rather different. So too, of course, does the resounding lack of even a single Quranic inscription dating from the reigns of his predecessors, and so too do the scattered hints from contemporaries. Christian scholars, noting for the first time the existence of writings attributed to Muhammad, describe them not as a single book, but rather as a jumble of fragments with such titles as The Cow, The Woman, and God's She-Camel. If true, then who might have been tracking down these various scraps of text and piecing them together? Certainly that Abd al-Malik's reign had indeed seen the Quran subjected to a state-sponsored makeover was something that no Muslim scholar would subsequently think to deny. In the vanguard of this editing process, as of so much else, was al-Hajjaj. Peerless warrior, formidable governor, he would also enjoy a splendid posthumous reputation as a proofreader of the Quran. Some traditions, however, would ascribe to him a role infinitely more intriguing. Rejecting the presumption that God, in the wake of Muhammad's death, no longer permitted his purposes to be known through the agency of mortals, Al-Hajjaj is said to have retorted, "I work only by inspiration." Ever the loyal servant, though, he always emphasized that his own role in collecting, collating, and distributing the revelations of Muhammad, heaven-sanctioned though it might be, was as nothing compared to that of Abd al-Malik. In fact, so Al-Hajjaj declared flatly, his master stood higher in God's view than did the angels and prophets. An opinion that the commander of the faithful himself, never a great one for modesty, did not think to dispute. The age of the prophets might have ended, but that did not mean, in the opinion of Abd al-Malik, that God had no further need of a chosen agent on earth. Deploying his favourite medium of coinage, he made sure to broadcast to the world precisely how he saw his role, as the Khalifat Allah, or Deputy of God. Just as Muhammad had been chosen to reveal the divine world, Abd al-Malik had been appointed to interpret it and broadcast it to humanity. And who was to say which one had been allotted the graver responsibility? Certainly the title of Caliph, introduced to the public gaze for the first time by Abd al-Malik's agents in the imperial mints, implied a dominance over realms that were no less supernatural than earthly. If it was upon the command of Abd al-Malik that roads were built and dams constructed, then it was also through his person that people might pray for rain. Formidably though his warriors stood guard upon the frontiers of the empire, yet they were not so formidable as the Caliph himself, who stood guard upon the highway that led to heaven. A beater of skulls, he was also the ultimate Imam of guidance. These vaunting claims were not mere idle propaganda. The breathtaking scope of Abd al-Malik's ambition was matched only by the sheer drive and creative brilliance with which he sought to fulfil it. By the time of his death in 705, a ramshackle patchwork of conquests that only 2 decades previously had been on the verge of utter disintegration had been reconstituted as a state no less brutally efficient than had been its toppled predecessors. Even more awesomely, it had been consecrated to a vision of the due owed by humanity to the divine that brooked very little contradiction. Religion, in God's eyes, is submission. So Muhammad had declared. Featured on the Dome of the Rock, however, the meaning of the verse had been subtly altered. The submission demanded by God had come almost to serve as a proper noun. The faith proclaimed by Abd al-Malik, lord of an empire that reached from the rising to the setting of the sun, had been given a name. The slogan stamped on the Dome of the Rock had become one fit for the entire world. Religion, in God's eyes, so it declared, is Islam. Sunna side up. An ancient city, like a battle-scarred veteran, might often wear the marks of long-concluded wars. In Syria, no city was more ancient than Damascus. Indeed, the fame of its delights, from its climate to its plums, reached so far back in time that there were some rabbis prepared to rank it as a gateway to paradise. A whole century after its conquest by the Arabs, and 4 centuries after the reign of Constantine, Damascus had still not sloughed off every last mark of its pagan past. High and massive above the sprawl of the teeming markets, there loomed the walls of what might have seemed, to the first-time visitor, a particularly brooding citadel, but was in truth the outer shell of what had once been the city's most domineering temple. Worship on the site was as old as Damascus itself, and as continuous. Although Jupiter, the deity in whose honour the sanctuary had originally been erected, no longer sat enthroned within the vast building, the walls themselves had been spared demolition by the triumphant Christians, and consecrated anew to the service of their own god. Now, however, 715 years on from the birth of Christ, a new faith had laid claim to the shrine. Not a trace remained of the cathedral that only a decade previously had nestled within the temple walls. In its place, marble-lined and mosaic-adorned, there had been raised a stupefyingly beautiful new monument, one so lavishly adorned that a train of 18 camels, it was claimed, had been required merely to take away the builder's receipts. And the new owners? An inscription emblazoned on one of the walls left no one in any doubt. "Our Lord is God alone," it proclaimed. "Our religion is Islam, and our prophet is Muhammad. May God incline unto him and give him greeting." About 2.5 decades earlier, when Abd al-Malik had commissioned the dome on the rock, he had done so with a wary eye on Jerusalem's great churches, and made a point of using its walls to rubbish the doctrine of the Trinity. Walid, Abd al-Malik's eldest son, and the caliph responsible for the sumptuous new mosque in Damascus, was altogether more self-assured in the practice of his faith. Rather than keep glancing over his shoulder at the ludicrous errors of the Christians, he simply ignored them. It was through his identity as someone who submitted to God, as a Muslim, that Walid defined himself, and certainly not in relation to some lesser and superseded faith. Such self-confidence was hardly surprising. The splendours of Walid's mosque bore stunning witness to the full range of blessings that had been showered by an approving deity upon the followers of Islam. The fire of jewels quarried from the highest mountains, the shimmer of pearls harvested from the depths of the oceans, the columns plundered from demolished cathedrals, and the mosaics crafted by the most brilliant artists of the age, all served to demonstrate the unrivalled reach of the Caliphate Allah. Well might visitors to the mosque have reported, and believed, a rumour that one of its pillars had been fashioned out of the magnificent throne of the Queen of Sheba. Just as Islam contained within itself all that was best and most noble in other faiths, the great mosque of Damascus enclosed within its towering walls any number of treasures garnered from vanished dominions, detritus reconfigured in the cause of a new and universal empire. There is hardly a tree or a notable town that has not been pictured on those walls. So wrote one admirer, in the assurance that the images he could see portrayed on them, from winged plants to hippodromes, were nothing if not a reflection of the many lands, extending infinitely beyond Damascus, that had been brought beneath the sway of Islam. By 715, when Walid declared his great mosque open, Arab armies had long since swept far beyond the limits of the crumbled empires ruled from Ctesiphon and the new Rome. In the east, they had advanced into the one-time kingdom of the Heftalites, passing not only the abandoned red wall of Gergan, but an even mightier barrier, the river Oxus, a natural frontier so immense and fast-flowing that the Arabs would come to define the whole vastness of Central Asia simply as Transoxania. Meanwhile, in the west, with Carthage and the long coastal strip of North Africa already subdued, they had crossed the sea in pursuit of fresh conquests. In 711, a tiny Arab raiding party had landed on Gibraltar. Within the course of only a few months, this venturesome warband had succeeded in defeating the Visigoths in battle, killing their king and seizing their capital of Toledo, deep in the vitals of Spain. An achievement such as this, secured on the outermost edge of the world, appeared so astounding to the Arabs as to verge on the fantastical. Stories of the conquest, told back in Damascus, cast Spain as a land of mysteries and wonders, where statues spoke, locked rooms contained miraculous visions of the future, and cities were made of bronze. So astounding had the scope of Arab triumphs become that they no longer seemed wholly real. Which said, the proofs of Muslim conquests were a simple enough matter for anyone in Damascus to track down. Leave behind the courtyard of Walid's mosque, with its gleaming marble and delicately ornamented fountains, and there, in the city's markets, penned amid their own filth and misery, were to be found human cattle, corralled from every corner of the world. The stories told of Spain might have been conjured from a realm of fantasy, but not so the coffle of 30,000 prisoners brought back to Syria by the conquerors of the Visigoths. Nothing had served more violently to rub the noses of the vanquished in the brute fact of the Arabs' might than the depredations of their slavers. Annually, one monk recorded, their robber bands went to distant parts and to the islands, bringing back captives from all the peoples under the heavens. Of course, there was nothing particularly novel about this expression of superpower status. The Romans had never shown the slightest hesitation in selling off inveterate rebels such as the Samaritans, while the presumptions governing the Persians' treatment of their prisoners of war had been evident in the fact that Ansharig, their word for slave, had originally meant foreigner. Now, though, the boot was very much on the other foot. Wretches harvested from the former provinces of the Christian Empire toiled on the estates or in the mines of great Arab landowners, and although it was not unknown for the odd prayer to be heard and the occasional slave driver to be felled by some miraculous act of the Virgin Mary, most could only lament that they had been abandoned by the heavens. "Why does God allow this to happen?" Such was the cry that had gone up back in the time of Umar, when a band of Arab slavers had raided a festival held in the hills outside Antioch in celebration of St. Simeon's sojourn on his pillar. It was not only Christians who might ask the question. The terrible violence that marked the conquest of the Sasanian heartlands had seen the markets of Kufa and Basra flooded with a quite staggering number of Persian captives, while even on the easternmost frontiers of Iran, where Arab control was altogether more precarious, a tribute of slaves was the very least that might be demanded by the conquerors. Typical was the fate of Saranj, a great fortress that commanded the approaches to the Hindu Kush, whose inhabitants had agreed, as a term of their surrender, to deliver annually 1,000 of their most beautiful boys, each one holding in his hands a golden cup, a delicious foretaste for pious Muslims of the delights of paradise. Like the blades of a giant plough, then, the Arab armies sliced apart families, scattered communities far and wide, churned up and mingled peoples who might otherwise never have met. Not since the first coming of Rome to the Near East 800 years earlier, when the conquest of the region by the legions had reputedly seen 10,000 slaves sold daily in a single entrepot, had there been transplantation of human livestock on anything like such a scale. Naturally, for the Arabs themselves, there was peril as well as profit in this trade. Just as Italy, back in the distant days of the Roman Republic, had repeatedly been racked by slave revolts, so too, in times of fitna, at the heartlands of the Caliphate. Amid the chaos that followed the death of Muawiyah, for instance, an army of prisoners of war had broken free and made a stronghold of Nisibis, so that dread came upon all the Arabs. Nor dread alone, spluttering indignation as well. "Our slaves are rebelling against us," so the warlords of Kufa had exclaimed in outrage, "but they are our booty, granted us by God." To the rebels themselves, however, it was far from self-evident that God did intend them to rank as booty. Presumptions that had underpinned the Roman slave trade back in its heyday were not all they once had been. Over the course of the centuries, callousness had grown ever less innocent. Among Christians, for instance, in an empire that had learned to take seriously St. Paul's injunction that there was neither slave nor free in Christ, the habit of regarding human chattels as mere walking machines had become increasingly problematic. "If God does not enslave what is free," as one bishop sternly inquired of his slave-owning flock, Then who is he that sets his own power above God's? In Iran Shah, too, the communism preached by Mazdak had anticipated a golden age of universal brotherhood, when every class, so it was trusted, would be as one. It was true, of course, that Mazdak's followers had ended up buried head first in Khusro's flowerbeds, and true as well that most Christian scholars, although they certainly regarded slavery as a damnable thing, tended to presume that it would endure until the end of days. Nevertheless, the logic of a faith that claimed all human beings, without exception, to have been created by a loving God, ensured that increasingly, in pious Christian circles, the freeing of slaves was regarded less as charity than as a pressing obligation. Similarly, dutiful Muslims, if they only paid close attention to the awesome conception of their responsibilities as articulated by the Prophet, could hardly dispute that even the very lowest of the low might be a brother. What will explain to you what the steep path is? So Muhammad, slave owner though he reputedly was himself, had demanded of his followers before supplying his own answer. It is to free a slave, to feed at a time of hunger an orphaned relative or a poor person in distress, and to be one of those who believe and urge one another to steadfastness and compassion. Which was all very well, except that there were plenty of Arabs who had not the slightest intention of sharing their God with foreigners. Right from the earliest days of their empire, they had been all too painfully aware of the danger of being swallowed up by the vast, amorphous mass of their subjects. This was why, in Iraq, they had founded entirely new cities on the margins of the desert. And it was why, in Syria and Palestine, where the Arabs had opted to settle directly among the natives, they had introduced a whole host of petty regulations in order to establish clear water between themselves and their inferiors. Christians, to their horror, found themselves subjected to laws originally designed by the Roman authorities to keep Jews in their place. Forbidden as they were to dress or speak like Arabs, to sit in the presence of an Arab, to wear swords, or to ride on a saddle, the chasm of difference that separated them from their overlords could hardly have been more humiliatingly emphasized. It was God who made you inherit their lands, their homes, and their wealth. So Muhammad had assured his followers. Well then might the Arabs, living off the fat of their conquests and revelling in their possession of a God-granted empire, have been protective of their winnings. Much, after all, was potentially on offer to those who could legitimately claim a descent from Ishmael. A couple of generations on from the defeat of the perfumed Romans and Persians, the taste for luxury of some Arabs would have given Umar apoplexy. Anxious though they were to differentiate themselves from the common run of their subject peoples, they did not have the slightest hesitation in aping the manners of the toppled ruling classes. In Syria, the furnishings of high-end properties owed nothing to Medina and everything to the Roman relish for wine, nude sculptures, and mosaics. In Iraq, the peacock tastes of the Persian aristocracy were enthusiastically adopted by wealthy Arab warlords, who delighted in parading through the streets of Kufa or Basra, arrayed in silken flares and shimmering robes of many colours, with their beards dyed a startling shade of yellow or red. Who, then, were the foreign slaves who escorted them on such processions, or kept their golden goblets polished back in their palaces, or toiled in chains on their fields, to imagine that they too might have a stake in such an inheritance? Yet in truth, any prospect of fashioning for the Arabs a religion comparable to that of the Jews, a legacy of faith born on the bloodline of Abraham, had already long since been dissolved upon the swirl and clamour of their dazzling conquests. When Al-Hajjaz, in 702, founded a new city named Wasit to stand sentinel between Kufa and Basra, and posted guards upon its gates to ensure that only Arabs could settle there, he was closing the doors of a stable from which the horse had long since bolted. How could there be any prospect of affirming the purity of an Ishmaelite descent, when the streets of Wasit, and of every other garrison city too, were filled with slaves uprooted from every corner of the world, deprived of their families, their homes, their native lands, and with no consolation save the glimpse of heaven provided them by the faith of their masters. These captives were not only to be found in the streets, they were in the conqueror's bedrooms too. The right to sleep with such slaves as God has assigned to you as war booty was one that Muslims could enjoy on the say-so of the Prophet himself, and plenty of them had duly capitalized upon it with relish. The slave markets of the Caliphate were so glutted with female flesh that wealthy Arabs might debate the various merits of the merchandise as though evaluating the pedigree of bloodstock. Abd al-Malik himself was a noted connoisseur. "He who wishes to take a slave girl for pleasure," the great caliph sagely advised, "let him take a Berber. He who wishes to take one as a domestic servant, let him take a Roman. And he who wishes to take one to produce a child, let him take a Persian." In Iraq, however, where the markets were particularly well stocked with women plundered from Iran, Persian girls' value was boosted by more than mere fecundity. Daughters from Zoroastrian families, each of whom was expected to kneel 3 times a day before her husband and humbly beg of him his desires, were famously well conditioned to obedience. At the absolute top end of this market were princesses of the House of Sasan. One raised the fabulous sum of 50,000 gold pieces, while another, a granddaughter of Khusro II himself, was installed in a specially built palace in Basra that supposedly had 1,000 gates. The children of such mothers, it went without saying, were hardly likely to rest content with a status as the inferiors of anyone. Nor, when slaves and their offspring looked around them at the insolent pride and squandered riches of their masters, could they fail to prick up their ears at the teachings of the Prophet. "You do not honour the orphan, nor urge one another to feed the poor. You consume an inheritance to the last mouthful, and you love wealth with a love inordinate." Here was a vision fit to inspire even the most downtrodden. Slaves might resent their masters, after all, and yet find fuel for that same resentment in the fecund range of their masters' beliefs. The rebels who seized control of Nisibis, for instance, had claimed to be followers of Mukhtar, and they were duly massacred as such. Others sought inspiration in the relish of the Shia for tyrant hatred. Then, with the ending of the fitnah and the great labour of forging performed by Abd al-Malik upon the half-fashioned doctrines and recollections of the Arabs, fresh opportunities for damning those who would scorn the wretched began to present themselves. Inadvertently, by their very public promotion of Muhammad as a messenger of God, the Umayyads provided those dismissed by the Arab warrior elite with a potent means of opposing their own continued subordination. With the likes of Al-Hajjaj enthroned behind gates and towers like latter-day Shahanshahs, those consigned to the stinking slums of Kufa or Basra might ponder the scorn of the Prophet for the arrogant and the overmighty, and fashion a very different understanding of Islam to that of the Caliph and his lieutenants. Meanwhile, beyond the ramparts of the great garrison cities of Iraq, others had also begun to observe the religion of the Arabs with a mixture of envy and fascination. After all, the Caliphate's subjects hardly needed to be sold into slavery to feel the sting of their own inferiority. As Arab rule increasingly came to be identified with Abd al-Malik's vision of Islam, so natives eager to join the society of their masters rushed to embrace the embryonic religion. Predictably, the Arabs, far from welcoming these converts as brothers, placed as many roadblocks as they could on the straight path. Those who wished to convert faced a whole host of indignities. It was not enough to submit to God. Only by submitting to an Arab patron as well might a Persian or an Iraqi or a Syrian come to be ranked as a Muslim. Here, for those with so much as a trace of snobbery, was a humiliation perhaps too far. Even for those habituated to tutelage, the path to Islam was rarely straightforward. During the reign of Abd al-Malik, for instance, when bands of Iraqi peasants converted en masse and took themselves off to the fleshpots of Basra, al-Hajjaj's response was iron-fisted. Far from delighting in a victory secured for Islam, he rounded up the renegades and returned them to the estates of their masters. Arab rule, as it had ever done, depended on the vanquished knowing their place. By the time of Walid and his successors, conversions to Islam were coming to threaten not merely the exclusivity of the conquerors, but the stability of the tax base. Abd al-Malik's reforms, by transforming the toppled empire's bureaucracies into something more acceptably Arabic, had given their extortions a tone that was increasingly Islamic too. Taxes were coming to be demanded not as dues of the kind that conquerors had always levied as a matter of course, but as something subtly different, a fine on unbelief. The prophet might not have anticipated that his followers would subdue the whole world, but he had still given them helpful tips on how Jews and Christians should properly be exploited. That God wished infidels to pay a poll tax, the jizya, to their Muslim masters, and to feel humiliated while doing so, was recorded in the Quran itself, after all. Granted, the precise form that this humiliation should take was something much disputed by commentators. Indeed, it was a mark of just how profoundly the chasm yawned between the compilation of the prophet's revelations into a single book and the original revelations themselves that the meaning of the Arabic phrase that specified how the jizya should be paid had ended up quite forgotten. Fortunately, though, despite the inadequacy of all the frantic efforts to make good this embarrassing amnesia, the underlying message of the verse remained clear enough. Jews and Christians, if they wanted the right to live unmolested, would have to pay for it. Tolerance might be theirs, but only at a price. Yet in truth, what made this protection racket viable was less the say-so of the Quran than presumptions forged over many centuries among Jews and Christians themselves. That the people of the book might be defined as such for taxation purposes was ringing and climactic affirmation of just how successful had been generations of rabbis and bishops in the construction of impregnable barriers around their respective faiths. In Iraq, certainly, where the Sasanian authorities had long categorized their subjects in religious rather than ethnic terms, Jew and Christian saw nothing remotely untoward in the weight-throwing of their new Muslim masters. Not, of course, that this made them any the keener to cough up taxes, and Christians in particular were often adept at evading them. One bishop in northern Iraq, for instance, managed to secure a tax exemption for his clergy by the dramatic expedient of casting out demons from the local governor's daughters. Meanwhile, a second governor granted rebates to a monastery in the Zagros Mountains after a hermit living there had healed his horse. No Christians, however, nor Jews, ever thought to dispute the right of the Muslim authorities to tax them. Protection in a world that had repeatedly been trampled down by contending war bands was usually held to be well worth the price. In general, then, to the Jews and Christians of Iraq, the coming of Islam had represented less a dramatic upheaval than the final institutionalizing of what they had always rather assumed was simply the way of the world. The followers of Zoroaster, however, saw the convulsions of the age in quite a different light. To pious worshippers of Ormazd, the collapse of Sasanian power and the conquest of Iran Shah was a calamity beyond their darkest nightmares. The faith was ruined, and the Shahanshah slain like a dog. So in numbed terms the catastrophe would always be commemorated by the Maubeds. The world passes from us. Toppled as it had been into the dust from its former position of privilege and power, the Zoroastrian church would never again enjoy the ear of kings. Instead, denied by the Quran even the pallid status enjoyed by rabbis or monks as peoples of the book, the Maubeds found their beloved religion of truth and light being treated with brutal contempt. In the eastern reaches of Iran, where Arab rule was most sketchy and dependent for such authority as it possessed upon treaties signed with still formidable Parthian dynasties, such as the Karin, fire temples might continue to blaze as they had ever done. But elsewhere, only payment of extortionate bribes could stave off their demolition. In Iraq, they had fast been obliterated altogether. Their scorched ruins were abandoned to weeds and black ravens, birds of ill omen that everyone knew were really demons. Many worshippers of Ormazd, witnessing fire temples lost to such darkness, found their faith in the Lord of Light mortally shaken. Under the House of Sasan, such apostasy would have been punishable by death, but no longer. Instead, where previously all had been checks and restrictions, Iraq had come to provide, in the first decades following the implosion of Sasanian authority, something it had not done for centuries, a free market in faiths. So where were the orphaned of Ormazd to go? Most, seeking shelter behind the most solid ramparts they could find, had turned in their misery to the Nestorian Church. As a result, Christians, far from being diminished by the Arab conquest of Iraq, rapidly became the majority. Under the strong and paternalistic rule of the Umayyads, they would enjoy a golden age. Across the northern reaches of Iraq, now far removed from the front line with the Romans, churches flourished as never before. Nisibis, especially, blazed with a particular brilliance. The city's scholars, who were as familiar with the classics of Greek philosophy as they were with those of their own faith, soon re-established it as the foremost centre of learning in the entire Fertile Crescent, and far beyond. Meanwhile, outpacing even the advance of the Arab armies, Christian missionaries had begun to fan out from Iraq, treading the roads that stretched eastwards to the fabulous kingdoms of India and China. In time, the head of the Nestorian Church would plan a bishopric for the peoples of Tibet, and the nomads of Mongolia adopt a version of the Syriac script. To many Christians, then, it appeared self-evident that the future of Asia belonged to them. Except that there lay open as well, for bewildered refugees from the Zoroastrian Church, the pathway to a very different faith, one as newly sprung and as yet unformed as Christianity was venerable and massy of structure. 100 years on from the Arab conquest, it was a common complaint among the ruling elite of the Caliphate that Zoroastrian converts to Islam have not become Muslims seriously, but only to escape the poll tax. But this was sorely to underestimate the appeal of their prophet's revelations. Tax dodge, though conversion certainly provided, yet it might represent as well something very much more. To the troubled, to the heaven-shadowed, to the seeker after truth, the awesome proofs that God had spoken to Muhammad were often irresistible. Guide us to the straight path, the path of those you have blessed, those who incur no anger, and who have not gone astray. How could the one-time Maubed, who, for the first time spoke these words, words that had supposedly proceeded from God himself, not feel redeemed from the many errors to which his previous faith had been prey? Yet he could know as well, even as he set off along the straight path, that the road ahead still had to be cleared and mapped. The revelations of Muhammad, unlike those of Zoroaster, had been in circulation for barely a century. Among the followers of Islam, there was nothing to compare with the ancient legacy of hymns, commentaries, and laws that had descended down the millennia to the Zoroastrian Church. Rather, in the great project of clarifying what precisely the prophet's message might have been, and the full scope of his intentions, there were roles aplenty for those, like former Maubeds, with an aptitude for scholarship. As a result, in mosques and courtyards across Iraq, converts from the Zoroastrian Church began to join the descendants of the Arab slaves and meet with them in their urgent striving to define what a properly Muslim society should be. Observing this process with some interest was a rabbi named Rav Yehudai. Living just a short distance from Kufa, in the great Talmudic school of Sura, he was well placed to note an intriguing development. The hearts of those Maobeds who had converted to the religion of the Ishmaelites, so he reported, were still not entirely clear of the trace of their former beliefs, even down to the third generation, for part of their original religion still remains within them. What evidence might the rabbi have had for making such a claim? Converts from the Zoroastrian church did often, it was true, bring with them into Islam notions that might have seemed distinctively their own. That apostates should be executed, for instance, or that prayers should be offered up 5 times a day, or that it was a singular mark of piety to use a toothbrush. Certainly there was no direct support in the Quran for any of these presumptions. Hell, not execution, was the fate that it prescribed for apostates. Prayers were mandated not at 5, but at 3 times a day, while of toothbrushes there was no mention at all. How strange it might have seemed, then, and how striking a coincidence, that Muslims, when dictating what the penalty for apostasy should be, or how many times a day they should pray, should increasingly have opted to side with Zoroastrian prescriptions, and ignore the Quran altogether. What was more, they had developed a positive craze for dental hygiene. Whenever the Prophet got up at night, he used to clean his mouth with a toothbrush. A most intimate detail, and one fit to gladden the heart of any former Maobed, certainly. But how, when some other Zoroastrian convert might simply have made it up, could he and the Muslim people as a whole be sure that it was actually true? Such a question was more than mere idle nitpicking. The subjects of Abd al-Malik, who almost overnight had found themselves being informed every time they pulled out a coin or received an official document that Muhammad was the Prophet of God, had not been slow to grasp the implications. Only established that an opinion had truly been voiced by this same Prophet of God, and it would immediately come to possess the full, terrifying force of eternal law. Here, for the restless and ever-growing number of Muslims who were unable to trace their origins back to the first generation of the conquest, who were resentful of the haughty Arab elite, and who yearned to fathom the true purposes of God, was a truly golden opportunity. Nevertheless, their way ahead was challenging. Unlike the Caliph, they could hardly claim to be God's deputies, graced by the heavens with a direct responsibility for defining and regulating the Muslim realm. Only by compiling the sayings of the Prophet could they possibly hope to trump the forbidding authority of the Caliphat Allah. If a Sunnah, a body of law capable of taming the extravagances and injustices of the age, were indeed to be fashioned without reference to the Caliph, then its origins would need to be grounded, and very publicly so, in the life and times of the Prophet himself. No other source, no other wellspring would possibly do. But how to authenticate Muhammad's sayings? Such was the question, a century on from the death of the Prophet, that confronted the first generation of a whole new class of scholars, legal experts whom Muslims would come to know as the Ulama. Fortunately for them, just across the mudflats from Kufa, where the yearning to forge a new understanding of Islam was at its most turbulent and intense, the perfect role models were ready to hand. The rabbis of Sura, after all, had been laboring for many centuries to solve precisely the sort of problem that now confronted the Ulama. The secret Torah, so it was recorded in the Talmud, had been received at Sinai by Moses, who communicated it to Joshua, who communicated it to the elders, who communicated it to the prophets, who in turn had communicated it to a long line of rabbis right down to the present. Nowhere in the world, in consequence, were there scholars better qualified to trace the chains of transmission that might link a lawyer and the sayings of a prophet than in the yeshivas of Iraq. Was it merely coincidence, then, that the earliest and most influential school of Islamic law should have been founded barely 30 miles from Sura. It was in Kufa, at around the same time as Walid, far distant in Damascus, was building his great mosque, that Muslim scholars first began to explore a momentous proposition, that there existed, alongside the Prophet's written revelations, other, equally binding revelations that had never before been written down. Initially, in the manner of rabbis citing their own masters, members of the ulama were content to attribute these hitherto unrecorded doctrines to prominent local experts. Then, as time went by, they began to link them to the Prophet's companions. Finally, as the ultimate in authorities, they fell to quoting the Prophet himself directly. Always, however, by bringing these previously unrecorded snatches of the past, these hadiths, to light, Muslim scholars were following a trail that had been blazed long before. Islamic, though the isnads were, they were also more than a little Jewish. The rabbis of Sura and Pumpedita, immured within their famous yeshivas, had spoken of their ambition to build a fence around the Torah. And so they had done, a thoroughly impregnable one. Yet some of them, hearing as a faint roar the tumult of debate and inquiry that was filling the streets of nearby Kufa, might just have felt a touch of claustrophobia, and even envy. The mosques of Iraq were coming to offer what no synagogue or church or fire temple had done for centuries, a venue for inquiry into the nature of God, where the terms of debate had not already long since been set in stone. More than that, in the teeming warrens of Kufa and Basra, people from various religious backgrounds were free to meet and collaborate and merge their perspectives in a way that had never been previously possible. There were the conquerors, the Arab elite, with their language, their venerable traditions and their burnished memories of the age of Muhammad. Then there were the slaves and the descendants of slaves, all impatient to apply to the wrongs of an unjust society the austere and chilling message of the Prophet. Finally, there were ever-increasing numbers of converts. Part of their original religion still remains within them. So Rav Yehudai, the rabbi of Sura, had observed of those Maobeds who turned to Islam. But what of those Muslims who had once been rabbis? Was the same to be observed of them? If so, that would certainly help to explain why the Sunnah, just like the Torah, aimed to regulate every dimension and aspect of human existence, why it should have forged for itself chains of transmission such as rabbis, and only rabbis, had ever previously deployed, and why, in direct contradiction of the Quran, it prescribed death as the punishment for adultery rather than whipping. As it had been written in the Torah by Moses himself, "They shall bring out the young woman to the door of her father's house, and the men of her city shall stone her to death with stones, because she has wrought folly in Israel by playing the harlot in her father's house." Such a ruling, once it had been reworked by Muslim lawyers, was no less authoritative for having been garnered from another and infinitely more ancient source. Rather like Walid's great mosque, the Sunnah was a monument to just what could be achieved by fashioning old fragments into something new and extraordinary. Shards gleaned from the Torah and from Zoroastrian ritual and from Persian custom, all featured in the edifice pieced together by the ulama. The consequence of their labours, taking on an ever more clearly delineated form as the decades of Umayyad rule slipped by, was a guide to the wishes of God of quite astounding potency, one that even the most chauvinistic governor might learn to ignore at his peril. Indeed, as a check upon the appetites and arrogance of an imperial elite, it was perhaps the most remarkable that a defeated people has ever devised. The ulama, whether descended from prisoners of war, or Zoroastrians, or Jews, were overwhelmingly comprised of the victims of the conquest. Yet they had won for themselves, by their collective efforts, a